I was asked if I could see how many people I could offend in all one place in one time, and so you'll let me know if I succeed in this. I first want to thank the numerous people who've helped me throughout my career, and this is a sort of culmination of the work that they all did, and I'm going to try to sell it to you now. I'm going to cover two major topics, and one is ammonium versus nitrate as a nitrogen source. The other is how photorespiration and nitrate assimilation can serve as a juncture between carbon-nitrogen relationships in plants. Starting out with ammonium and nitrate, I took this photo as sort of a science fiction photo, sort of has a inkling of 2001, because if you look at 95% of the literature on plants and nitrogen, they do not even mention what kind of nitrogen form is involved. They talk about total nitrogen and treat nitrogen as a monolith. And as we all know, that nitrogen comes in very distinct forms, and so the yin and the yang of inorganic nitrogen is ammonium versus nitrate, and these are distinct in many ways. I'm going to focus on the last item here on this list. Not only are they have different charges, but they have very different energy levels. That ammonium has an oxidation state of +3, where nitrate has an oxidation state of -5, and to convert nitrate into ammonium requires a transfer of 8 electrons, an enormous energy barrier. In most organisms, plants included, the process, biochemical process, involves the reduction of nitrate to nitrite, the reduction of nitrite to ammonium, and then the conversion of ammonium into glutamate, which is then into other amino acids and other organic nitrogen forms. In the leaves of higher plants, this occurs, the first reaction occurs in the cytoplasm. The second two are in the chloroplast, the stroma of the chloroplast. And it takes an enormous amount of energy to transfer those 8 electrons. If you put it on ATP equivalence, is this too loud, or am I just bellowing? A little bit too loud. I'll just wait till the people in the front start going back like that. If you put this on ATP equivalence, it takes 12 ATPs per nitrate converted into amino acid. So that moves us into carbon-nitrogen relationships. If you've been awake for the last 2 decades, you've probably seen this curve. This is the Keeling curve that follows the concentrations of carbon dioxide at the observatory in Mauna Loa over the period of time, over the last 60 years or so. And though you may be very familiar with this, you may be less familiar with this, and that is how this relates to CO2 levels that have been on Earth for the last 25 million years. So over on the right-hand side, we have today, and this is 25 million years ago. What it shows is that CO2 levels in the atmosphere have been below what we have today for the last 24 million years. That plants have been operating under low CO2 concentrations for the last 24 million years. This becomes important when we consider, in this audience, I won't need to spend much time on it, but photosynthesis versus its evil twin. So we have photosynthesis where we have a high energy substrate, a 5-carbon sugar, ribulose 1,5-bisphosphate. This is carboxylated through the auspices of an enzyme, the most prevalent protein on the planet, called Rubisco. And 6 cycles through this generates a high-energy carbon in a hexosugar. Low-energy carbon in a carbon dioxide gets converted via sunlight into a high-energy carbon in a hexosugar. Now, the evil twin is the flip side, where you take the same substrate, RUBP, the same enzyme, Rubisco, and you oxygenate the substrate. And therefore, one of the carbons in that 5-carbon sugar is released as CO2. A high-energy carbon gets converted into a low-energy carbon. The relative amounts of these two reactions depends on the relative concentrations of carbon dioxide and oxygen at the active site of the enzyme. And under current conditions, that there's about 3 turns of the photosynthesis for every turn of photorespiration. High CO2 favors photosynthesis, represses photorespiration. Low oxygen does the same thing. So what does this mean in terms of plants? It means that since 35% of the carbon in photosynthesis may be released through photorespiration, people have assumed that 35% of the energy in a plant is wasted through photorespiration. And therefore, if CO2 levels rise in the atmosphere as they are doing, and are anticipated to double in the next few decades, you would expect a boon in plant photosynthesis and productivity. And indeed, if you look at, these are all the studies I've been able to find where people have exposed plants to elevated CO2 for long periods of time. In the first couple of years of exposure to elevated CO2, you can see there is about a 35-40% stimulation in biomass production. Again, here it's zero means that there's no difference between the ambient CO2 treatment and the elevated treatment. The upper scale is 100, meaning there's a doubling in biomass under elevated CO2. We can see that there's a 35% increase in productivity biomass under elevated CO2, but that disappears with time. In fact, a place not too far from here, Stanford University, long-term exposure to elevated CO2 ends up with a net decline in productivity. But it's true in all the other places as well that productivity seems to decline with time. This is heavily correlated with a decline in plant nitrogen. So here is the various crop plants and the protein concentration in those crop harvested part from face sites across the planet. And something that was led by Sam Myers, and I participated in as well. Zero means no difference in protein under elevated and ambient CO2. Minus 20 means a 20% decline in protein. C3 grains like wheat, rice, and barley show an 8 to 15% decline in grain protein with elevated CO2. Potato, the tuber protein, goes down about 10%. Legumes are different because of their source of nitrogen, and there's no significant difference in the two treatments. C4 grasses have about a minus 5% decline, but the variation is quite high. What we've discovered, and I've been proselytizing for the last few years, is that the reason for this is quite unexpectedly, elevated CO2 prevents plants from converting nitrate into protein in their shoots of C3 plants. Here are 8 different species of monocots, dicots, gymnosperms, angiosperms. This axis is internal CO2 concentration. This axis is a real-time, non-destructive measure of nitrate assimilation. And in all cases, as CO2 internal increases through increasing CO2 ambient, you find that nitrate assimilation becomes indistinguishable from zero. C4 plants show very little change with internal CO2 concentration. You have to keep in mind this is 2.4, this is 0.12. We looked at C3, C4 intermediates, and it was not as exciting as we hoped because the response was intermediate. And so if you put them all into one panel, as we have done in the lower right-hand side, you can see that C3 plants have a very strong inhibition with rising CO2. C3, C4, intermediate, and C4 are much less so. We've done this about 10 different ways. Here's 2 more different ways. This is nitrate assimilation. The no label was plants were starved of nitrogen. Then we gave them a pulse of nitrate. We followed how much entered the plant and how much remained unassimilated in the plant tissue and used that as a measure of nitrate assimilation. The N14 label, we labeled plants with N15 for their whole life. They were 90%. N15, we gave them a pulse of N14 nitrate and followed that to determine how much of that was converted into protein. The red lines, the left-hand bars of both Arabidopsis and wheat, are the plants that were exposed to ambient CO2 and ambient oxygen. The blue bars, the middle bars, were the plants that were exposed to elevated CO2 and ambient oxygen. The green bars, the right-hand bars, were those exposed to elevated ambient CO2 and low oxygen. Both the blue and the green are conditions that inhibit photorespiration. You can see that through both techniques and in both species, that inhibiting photorespiration inhibits the amount of nitrate that's assimilated. We also looked at growth of plants, and this is one of the most stark ones. Anyone here from the Northeast? If you are, you know that sugar maple is sugar maple syrup is a wonderful thing. And sugar maple is unique among hardwoods in that it is heavily dependent on nitrate as a nitrogen source. The upper two pictures are for plants that are under ambient. Lower two are plants that are under elevated CO2. The right-hand side are nitrate. The left-hand side are ammonium, was given as a sole nitrogen source. You can see that under elevated CO2 and nitrate, the plants cannot assimilate the nitrate, and the plants look extremely bad. Now you say, well, those are lab experiments. You know, how does that relate to the real world? So we collaborated with Bruce Kimball. He's talking very while I'm talking here, so I don't think we'll have a chance to run into one another. But they had a face experiment on wheat in Maricopa, Arizona. And this is a picture of their face rings, free air carbon dioxide enrichment rings, where they ran it for about 4 years, 2 years, and had usable data. And so we looked at the samples they collected. And those wheat samples under the 2 years, there were no significant differences in the ambient versus elevated CO treatments and the total nitrogen collected in those tissues. But if one looked at how much of that total nitrogen was unassimilated nitrate, you can see that it was significantly greater. We have three other measurements that show that indeed the difference between the two treatments was not the total amount of nitrogen, but how much of the nitrate was assimilated into protein. So this reinforces the idea that CO2 enrichment inhibits nitrate assimilation. So what are the mechanisms involved? And the first one, which you hopefully have gathered from my introduction, is photorespiration. And there'll be a quiz on this. No, this is from a review we did on photorespiration. And let's point out the salient points here. This is the step where Rubisco either oxygenizes the substrate RUBP or it carboxylates it. As there's more oxygenation, there's more malate formed in the chloroplast. More of that malate goes translocated to the cytoplasm, and that greater amount of malate generates NADH, and that enhances the amount of nitrate converted into nitrite. What we're showing now is that these are not happenstance, that in fact higher photorespiration leads to greater malate production through the generation of reductant. So the take-home message is plants are not stupid, and they have not been stupid for 24 million years. The idea that this low CO2 is just happenstance and that photorespiration has persisted because plants can't do anything about it, I protest that. And this is evidenced by the fact that nitrate assimilation depends on photorespiration. Conditions that inhibit photorespiration, high CO2, low oxygen, inhibit nitrate assimilation. It's true in monocots, dicots, gymnosperms species. And this allows plants to use nitrate, a form of nitrogen that most organisms do not want to use because the energetics are highly unfavorable. But this gives them a way of using this form of nitrogen. And it's also, this really says that breeding for low photorespiration, which has been a goal of many research programs, perhaps some that are presented here, have not been successful. And because it's not a great idea, because plants use photorespiration to good effect. It also shows if you add the energy that can be used to generate amino acids from nitrate, that C3 carbon fixation is much more efficient than people have given it credit for. It's more efficient than C4 and under most temperature regimes. And this explains, like, if we were to go outside, how many C4 plants would we see outside today? Zero. C4 plants are a very narrow niche, restricted to very hot, dry environments. And 94% of the plant biomass is in C3 plants, not C4 plants, despite 24 million years of low CO2 atmospheres. So breeding for C4 white, wheat or rice is not such a great idea either. Okay, I want to end up with talking about one other mechanism which affects a lot of the experiments that have been presented here, and that is that another mechanism through which CO2 inhibits nitrate assimilation is that it competes with nitrate for translocation from the cytoplasm into the chloroplast. And these are data that have just been submitted in Arabidopsis and wheat. This is assimilation under four conditions: ambient CO2 day and night, ambient CO2 during the day, elevated at night, elevated during the day, ambient at night, elevated during the day and night. And what you can see that exposure to elevated CO2 at night inhibits nitrate assimilation as well through the mechanism of inhibiting nitrate translocation into the chloroplast. This is another type of measurements, measuring the ratio of CO2 to O2 coming off the plant tissue. Just focus on this last column, and this is a measure of the amount of nitrate being assimilated at night from those gas fluxes. What you can see is that the elevated CO2 is the dark purple, the ambient is the light. You can see that there is a strong inhibition of nitrate assimilation in the dark under elevated CO2. Where this comes to play is that the vast majority of experiments that are done in the field under elevated CO2, all the major FACE experiments except for the Maricopa one that we worked with, do not control CO2 at night. That is, they let it run to ambient at night. And this is under the assumption, which we've shown to be incorrect, that CO2 levels at night do not influence plant productivity. And in fact, they do, as we've just shown you data. So some of the take-home messages here is that with elevated CO2, we expect that ecosystems where ammonium is the dominant form of nitrogen available to plants will be stimulated. Elevated CO2 in ecosystems where nitrate is the dominant form of nitrogen, such as many agricultural systems and many pasture systems, will be inhibited. And that plant nitrogen levels, particularly protein levels, will decline if nitrate is the dominant form of nitrogen available to the plants. Now, this not only affects human nutrition, but it affects pest management, because when the pest is eating material that is 20% less protein, what do they do to compensate? They eat 20% more, so pest problems become more severe. Thank you.
So we have, perhaps have time for a couple of very quick questions. Murray, do you want to challenge anything that was said there?
Throw the gauntlet down. That it interferes with the translocation of nitrite into the chloroplast, and we've shown that. So the nitrate is converted to nitrite in the cytoplasm. That has to go into the chloroplast, and that's inhibited by high CO2.
Okay, quick one, last one.
C4 legumes, you said? Well, legumes. C4 legumes are a separate case that in that their nitrogen source is independent of what I was talking about. I'm having difficulty hearing.
Why would it be a separate case?
Why would it be a separate case? Because their nitrogen form comes from atmospheric nitrogen that's fixed by the organism and passed by the symbiont into the host plant. There could be, I'm just thinking, I don't know, how many C4 legumes are there? None. Okay. Okay. So you're asking why is there an absence of C4 legumes? Why is there an absence of C4 trees? That's also a major question. Maybe my colleagues can help me.
Well, we're going to have a chance for discussion at the end, so maybe
Great.
Have a think about that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Arnold. Mm.